All right. Let's take our Bibles, please. We'll turn to the book of Revelation once again, this time to chapter 20. Chapter 20. Will you stand with me, please, for the reading of God's holy word? Revelation 20. I'll read the entire chapter. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain. And he seized the dragon, that ancient serpent who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years and threw him into the pit and shut it and sealed it over him so that he might not deceive the nations any longer until 1,000 years were ended. After that, he must be released for a little while. Then I saw thrones, and seated on them were those to whom the authority to judge was committed. Also I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for the testimony of Jesus and for the word of God, and those who had not worshipped the beast or its image and had not received its mark on their foreheads or on their hands. They came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. The rest of the dead did not come to life until 1,000 years were ended. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is the one who shares in the first resurrection. Over such, the second death has no power, but they will be priests of God and of Christ, and they will reign with him for 1,000 years. And when 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations that are at the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. Their number is like the sand of the sea. And they marched up over the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. But fire came down from heaven and consumed them. And the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur, where the beast and the false prophet were. And they were tormented. They will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Then I saw a great white throne and him who was seated on it. From his presence, earth and sky fled away, and no place was found for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, standing before the throne, and books were opened. Then another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged by what was written in the books, according to what they had done. And the sea gave up the dead who were in it. Death and Hades gave up the dead who were in them. And they were judged, each one of them, according to what they had done. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death, the lake of fire. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. God adds his blessing to the reading of his word. Do be seated, please. Well, of all the controversial chapters in all the controversial books, chapter 20 of Revelation has to rank right up there as one of the more difficult passages to interpret, and one which is the subject of some of the hottest debates in church history, the cause of splits in many churches, an eschatological club with which people pummel each other until either their opponents submit or run crying from the room. It's often even a test of orthodoxy by some. None of this surprises us. Really, I wouldn't expect it to surprise you. I would expect that you know that these things are true. What might surprise us is that in some senses, it really isn't all that difficult to get the thrust of the passage. I mean, not really. We're talking about the climatic crescendo of Christ's victory in these passages. The blessed truth that God wins just oozes from every sentence of this chapter. And if we don't understand all the details perfectly, I mean, how is that different from any other less controversial passages out there that we receive and so on? It comes down, I think, the arguments many times, I'm afraid, come down to a sense of pride. You know, Paul deals with this pride in the book of Galatians, for example, when he's dealing with folks who claim to have a secret inner knowledge about things. And that use that as a way to assert their superiority and influence over others. I've received the truth, you obviously haven't. And Nowhere can that be more easily done than in terms of eschatology when we really don't know what's going to happen. But boy, I'll tell you, we can sure speculate. And we can do all of our reasoning, we do all our thinking and come down to, yes, I've got it. But I'd like to, before we get too much further, I'd like you to turn to the book of Acts, chapter 1. Acts chapter 1, Jesus, Luke opens up there and describes just a general description of Jesus' appearances, and then noted that when they had come together, this is verse 6, they said, Lord, when will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? That is an eschatological question. Are all the promises that you have put forth, is now the time, now that you've risen, Are you now going to ascend the throne, and is Israel going to receive all the promises that were promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? And notice what Jesus says. It is not for you to know the times or seasons that the Father has fixed by his own authority. There's a splash of cold water. I mean, wouldn't you like, if you were one of those disciples, you'd be going, oh, yeah, is now the time, boy, and we're going to know. We're going to be the first to know that now's the time. And Jesus throws a bucket of ice water on that attitude real fast. It's not your business to know. Now, that doesn't mean it's not your business to consider and think about. We're told the book of Revelation is a book of blessing to read and consider these things, and it is. But for us to be definitive about things that God has not chosen to be utterly definitive about is arrogant. Rather, Jesus says, you're going to receive power when the Spirit has come upon you, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the end of the earth. In other words, you've got all kinds of work to do right now, today. Don't be worrying about what's going to happen next. And nailing down the timeline. So those words, coupled with what we see in the back to Revelation 20 there, trying to figure out, all right, when's all this going to take place and how's it all work together? And you know, we have various opinions of it. You can see from, and I told you what mine is, and you know, my chart there, you kind of see how it works out. But of course, others would vigorously disagree, and that's fine. But the point is that we ought to have some humility as we explore the statements that are here. And as we do, well, the blessing that we find here will be obvious. And that blessing is the assertion and the confident assertion that God will bring an end to sin once and for all. And I don't know about you, but whenever that day happens, I'm looking forward to it. Not only to the end of sin in my own life, but in the sin everywhere else about us. Well, this morning we're going to begin looking at this chapter, and Lord willing, we'll get through verse 6, and then when I'm back in a couple of weeks, we'll pick up at verse 7 and finish the chapter. But I want you to notice, first of all, that the beginning of the end of sin starts with the dealing with our great adversary. He was ordained to this end from the very beginning, verses 1 through 3. We've already seen the beast and the false prophet cast into the lake of fire. The beast has been defeated. The apostate church has been defeated. And this is just a continuation of that same narrative. It is the next section. Chapter and verse numbers don't really mean a whole lot because they're not original. But in any case, this is a continuation of the victory of the Lamb. Okay? So we're just continuing to explore what we've been looking at the last couple of weeks. But here we have the dragon himself. Now it's been, like I say, the apostate church and the beast and the false prophet, and now the dragon that is being dealt with. And notice that his incarceration here that's described is pretty ignominious. There's more about getting rid of the beast than there is about the dragon. And I don't think that's, well, no, it's not an accident. But it's basically, you look at this, and with the beast, you have the armies, and you have all that stuff that's going on, and the devil's going to raise up an army. We just read about that when he's released for that last hurrah. But at this point, it just says an angel comes down with a chain and a key and throws him in there, seals it up, it's done. Now, this is just, there's no great huge battle. It's not calling Michael and Gabriel and anybody else they can get to, you know, all the big guys. It's just this nameless angel that comes, latches on to Satan, and casts him in the bottomless pit. He's just put down by this no-name angel, if we can put it that way. But notice how he is described, the adversary. He's described as the dragon. Dragon, this destructive aggressor against God's people. A serpent, the ancient serpent, the suave deceiver who lured Adam and Eve to their spiritual and physical destruction. The devil, who is the devil? This word is the word in Greek. It means the slanderer. He's the one who slanders God's people and causes slander to God's name in the earth as well. But he is a slanderer. And then Satan, the adversary, he's an accuser. This is this great dragon, and yet he is put down and restricted for a time. He's bound for 1,000 years, thrown into the bottomless pit, shut it, sealed in, so that he might not deceive the nations any longer until the 1,000 years were ended. So his slanders, this slanderer, this accuser, his slanders against God and against his people are prevented for a time. George Eldon Ladd, in his commentary on Revelation, made this statement about this verse. His incarceration in the abyss does not mean that all of his activities and powers are nullified, only that he may no longer deceive the nations as he has done through human history and lead them into active aggression against the saints during the 1,000 years. Depending on your millennial perspective, what you think the 1,000 years means, and if we're in it now, or if it's still yet future, or if it's just entirely figurative and doesn't really relate at all to any particular time period. During this time, it's very clear to my mind. I do not understand how you can come to any other conclusion that during that time, Satan is not deceiving, at least not in the way, to the extent that he had done so before. And then I look at today and see Satan doing lots of deceiving, and people are just as wicked as they ever have been. And you wonder, well, okay. To my mind, that's a pretty strong argument that 1,000 years hasn't happened yet. Not everybody agrees with that, but that's just where I'm coming from. But what is very clear is that whatever this is, Satan will be curtailed. He will be prevented from going out and raising up the rebellion, the insurrection against God for a time. And we'll talk about the 1,000 years in just a minute. But we need to just remember, as we talk about the beginning of the end of sin, the adversary was ordained for this from the beginning. You know, when Satan fell, when he lifted up his soul, his heart, against his Creator God, and was cast out of heaven with those that followed him. Don't you know that he did not do that ignorantly? It's not going to be any shock to Satan that he's going to be thrown into the lake of fire. What? I did something wrong? Or this is my end? Or this is what, God's really more powerful than I am? I don't think Satan's going to be surprised at any of this. He has been working to slander his God. He knows him. The devils know God better than we ever will in this life. So there's no surprise to Satan and his demonic beings when they get punished. But it's the beginning of the end. Satan had to know from the first time he rebelled against God that this day was coming. That he would be put down. And so, the beginning of the end, it's not final yet. He's going to be released in a little bit. But let me say a word about the pit itself. We see this a couple times in the book of Revelation. And, you know, whether it's an actual literal pit, physically a pit there somewhere in some time-space continuum or whatever, I don't know, and frankly, I don't care. The imagery is the thing. It's putting away, out of sight, out of mind, out of harm's way, as in the harm of the rest of us. This great adversary, and it would be very very consistent with how prisons would have been viewed at that time, where generally deep dark holes in the ground and where the key got thrown away, particularly for serious incarceration. So anyway, this is just magnified. The bottomless suggests there's no way out of this. There's no stability. There's no foothold for him to work from. So we'll just take it at that, and if it's an actual literal place, we'll find it's an actual literal place, and that may very well be. Certainly, this is the image that is given to the Apostle John. Now, then we come to the passage of contention for so many people, verses 4 through 6, where we read of the thousand-year period and the rule of the victims of the adversary who are ruling righteously with Christ. Now, on its surface, again, there's no mystery here. There really isn't. Those who are Christ, those who have been beheaded, those are the martyrs. They're going to rule with Christ for 1,000 years, whatever that is. But they are in this period of bliss without the opposition and the affliction of the adversary wreaking havoc everywhere. And there is an extended period of gorgeous, beautiful, peaceful, strong reign of King Jesus on this earth. That is what is said. Why it's so hard for us to come to grips with what it really means, I think, is by God's design. Because it is not for us to know the times and the seasons. That's His business. We can know what He's going to do, and when the times and seasons arrive that He's ordained, we're going to know it. Won't be any doubt. We'll know who's in charge, and all the mystery will be done. But for now, it can be a little muddy, even though you read some writers, and it's like, oh, well, this is absolutely clear, and anybody else who believes otherwise is fooling themselves or is ridiculous or misses the other. I think that when Jesus said no man knows the day or the hour, and it's not for us to know the times and the seasons, that we ought to take Him seriously. But notice some things that we can know here. The oppressed are vindicated. And it really does help if you consider this passage in the light of everything else that we've seen in this book regarding the oppressed, particularly those who are martyred for their faith. It started early on in the book. Chapter 4, chapter 7, chapter 11 too, I think. Other places where you've got the martyrs who are crying out, Lord, how long? They're suffering. They're giving their lives. The Lord just says, be patient, be patient, be patient. The time is coming. The wrath's not full. It's coming. And now they are going to be lifted up. says they were beheaded, those who were beheaded for the testimony of Jesus. Beheaded being one particular type of execution. It would not have been the only one, but this is a representative manner of their execution as they were martyred for the cause of Christ. Now, let's think a little bit about where this rule is taking place. And this passage is a little bit challenging. There's irregular Greek here that does make it a challenge to interpret exactly what is being said. Are there two groups of saints referred to here? Or just one? There's arguments both ways. So in verse 4, when John sees thrones, and seated on those thrones were those to whom the authority to judge was committed, where are those thrones? Are they in heaven? Or are they on earth? This verse, by the way, is often seen as a strong argument for some aspects of the amillennial view, and seeing the throne here, the thrones as being a heavenly thing. This is a spiritual rule. It's not really an earthly rule. That's the argument. I don't hold that view, but nonetheless, that this verse can be argued that way. If you have two groups, then you're talking about saints in general in heaven on the thrones there. And then you've got martyrs who are ruling in some fashion or the other, who resurrected to reign on the earth. Now we'll explore that just a little bit. Sorry, I'm going into a little bit of a Sunday school mode here, because we've got to explore some of these things before we can get to really get at the principles anyway. So in chapter 2 and verse 26, which is Christ speaking to the church at Thyatira. If you've been with us throughout this series, you may remember that Thyatira was at the center of that chiastic development of those seven churches. Everything moved towards Thyatira. The tiniest place on the map stuck out in the middle of a wide valley, which was a huge battleground, and it was a garrison town that was fought over and won and lost and won and lost over and over again, and the people just really figured out how to go along, to get along and be diplomats and so on, because they never knew who was going to rule over them, and compromise was a big issue at that church. But it says there, Christ says to Thyatira that those who will hold fast, in the garrison mentality, if they will hold fast until he comes, they will join with him in ruling with a rod of iron. So this rod of iron business and ruling with Christ is nothing new. In fact, Jesus, of course, told his disciples that as well, didn't he? And then in chapter 3 and verse 21, an unlikely church, you know, when you start thinking about the seven churches, you think about those who are ruling and sitting with Christ and in power and so on, would come from Philadelphia or Smyrna. But no, this is Laodicea in chapter 3 and verse 21. And he tells them there, to the one who conquers, that one who conquers will sit on the throne with me, just as I have conquered and rule. If you conquer, you will rule with me and share with me in that rule. So this is not a new concept at all throughout the book. And then in chapter 5 and verses 9 and 10, the declaration once again is that the saints shall rule on earth. So you got to figure out, all right, are there these two spheres? Number one. Or is it that are in view, or is it just one? Take a look, if you will, at Daniel chapter 7. You can turn over there. Daniel 7 and verse 9. Strong parallel passage to to Revelation 20. And in chapter 7, verse 9, we read, as I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000 thousands served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. Does that sound like what we just read in Revelation 20? Absolutely it does. And this actually follows right along from the early verses of chapter 7 of Daniel, where the destruction, or the raising up of the beast and his destruction, then is spoken of in verse 11, that the beast was killed and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. So you have this, thrones were placed, and it's hard to tell whether that means heaven, though it says the Ancient of Days took his seat, so that suggests heaven, right? So a decent interpretation here is that there are two groups, saints in general that are in heaven on in a spiritual sense of rule and reign, and the martyred saints that are resurrected to reign on the earth during that thousand-year period. I mean, Paul asked the Corinthian church in verse 2 of chapter 6 of 1 Corinthians, "Do you not know that the saints will judge the world?" And that seems to be more the physical realm in view. I mean, it is simpler to see just one group, the thrones being those on earth that are filled by the martyrs of the tribulation. I think, to my mind, it's a given that the thrones on earth are filled by the martyrs of the tribulation. Whether there's the additional heavenly group, is a matter of discussion. But I have to ask myself this question. What will be the most comfort to a persecuted people who are seeing their loved ones perish? That's the context in which this book was written. I mean, this doesn't rule out other martyrs at any other time of any other time in human history. The focus is upon those, particularly during the time of tribulation that was described earlier, that we talked about, the mark of the beast and all of that, that brief, intense period of persecution and time. But again, if you don't think of that as a literal thing and the tribulation is, we're in the middle of it now and continuing ongoing, well, it could be all the martyrs. But martyrs are the key. And they will be vindicated and they will rule and reign. That we can rest assured of. And then notice what else it says here in verse 4. It speaks in verse 4, that verse 4 and 5. So they came to life, and they reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. And then almost a parenthetical, the rest of the dead did not come to life until the 1,000 years were ended. This is the first resurrection. So the coming to life of the martyrs and reigning with Christ is described as the first resurrection. In verse 4 there, it says that they came to life. That is the, it literally means they, you know, they became alive again. No mystery there. That's not a mysterious word at all. From a hermeneutics or interpretation point of view, that word is the most important one of the whole passage. Depending on what you think of that verb will determine what your millennial view is. I mean, maybe not in every single detail, but in general. The postmillennial view says that that means salvation. That it's not talking about physical death and coming back to life in a physical resurrection. It's speaking, the first resurrection is our salvation. And coming to life again is speaking about spiritual life. Premillennial view says that coming to life again means coming to life again. Means a resurrection, a physical resurrection, particularly in light of the rest of the passage, which says that they were dead, they were beheaded, they were executed. Those are not spiritual things. So big principle of hermeneutics or of interpretation is if you interpret one passage in one way and you should interpret the related passage in the same way. You don't say, well, the one's physical martyrdom, but this one's just spiritual resurrection. That's wrong. It doesn't work. I don't see any other way to take this as anything but physical resurrection here. It does not seem to me to be applying to living saints, because it's the first resurrection. If they were the living saints, that means they were dead before. Anyway, it doesn't really work too well if you try to take it as anything else but what it says literally. Others do, and you have to wrestle with that. But nonetheless, that's where I'm coming down on it and what I would urge upon you. And then there's the whole idea of the 1,000 years. Is this a literal 1,000 years? For many premillennialists, it is a literal 1,000 years. Not 999, not 1,001, but 1,000 years. And then to the amillennialists, this is an indefinite period. It's figurative. It's we're in the middle of it now. It's just an extended period. The postmillennialist sees it as actually a given period of time, start to finish. But some will say it's 1,000. Some will say it's just an extended period, but has a beginning and an end point, which amillennialists also suggest, but in a different way. It gets confusing. I think the best way to look at the 1,000 years is to recognize that there's, like many numbers in the book of Revelation, there is a symbolic feel to this number. 10 to the 3rd power. 10 is a number that often describes completeness. 3 is a number that describes intensity and truth, and also completeness and fullness. So when you do 10 to the 3rd, that's 1,000. It seems to me to be a figurative number of an extended period of time that is complete in and of itself. It accomplishes everything there. All of God's purposes are fulfilled. Now, some views say that this is referring to the church triumphant over time, or even the church militant as well, those who were on. But the problem is, if this is just over time, then you somehow have to go back and explain how the mark of the beast is that really referring to the same. If you take it as referring to all of church history, basically, you have to say the mark of the beast is there throughout all of it. And when this passage of scripture just says it's during the time of tribulation, so you see all this stuff is interconnected and can totally mind blown. You know, your head just kind of explodes. But take a look at Daniel 7 again. In Daniel 7, verse 9, he looks and he sees the thrones were placed. Revelation 20, verse 4, I saw thrones. In Daniel 7, verse 9, the court sits in judgment. In Revelation 20, and verse 4, seated upon those thrones were those to whom judgment was committed. In Daniel 7 and verse 22, judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came when the saints received the kingdom. Revelation 20 and verse 4, they came to life again and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. Revelation 20 and verse 4 is the very clear statement of the fulfillment of all the promises that were given to Israel, particularly as they're revealed there in the book of Daniel regarding the rule of Christ's saints with him on the earth. So that 1,000 years, if we're in the midst of it now, I struggle with that because this seems to be a physical rule. It is ruling with a rod of iron, which tells me something. It tells me that all is not sweetness and light in the hearts of men. Even though Satan has been bound and the beast and the false prophet have been cast in the lake of fire, there is still rebellion in the hearts of men. They're not being deceived in the same way during this time period. They're not organized. They don't have a leader, if you will. But we know that it's there because when this time period's over and Satan is released one more time, he's going to have no trouble amassing an army. So when we think about the place of God's rule, or of the rule of the saints, very possibly there is a heavenly component to this, a spiritual realm component to this, of those who were, you know, whose body is not resurrected yet, but whose souls were with Christ. But then the bodies resurrected of the martyrs will be ruling and reigning. And I'm telling you right now, they won't be headless. I mean, it's going to be restored there. And I'm not trying to be light about that. It says they were beheaded. So if they're resurrected, that means those things are going to be restored and they're going to be reigning. Now, why is that significant? Well, think about verse 6. Blessed and holy is the one who shares in the first resurrection. Those martyrs who are, there's a special blessing there. That they're restored from their martyrdom. Over such, the second death has no power. We know the second death is described as the lake of fire in verses 14 and 15. The first death would be what? Be the death of the body. Right? The second death is that living death for eternity in the lake of fire. And the second death has no power of them. You know, think about Lazarus, for example, who was raised again from the dead. Or little child to whom Talitha Kumi was said, little girl, arise. The widow's son, and others who died again, right? So they were still subject to the first death. But the second death has no power over those whom the Lord has redeemed, and over these martyrs, there's no power there. And it says that they will be priests of God and of Christ. They will reign with him for 1,000 years. So the second resurrection is described in verse 12, actually. The first resurrection is the martyrs. The second resurrection is when the dead, small and great, are raised up and stand before the great white throne. And some off to are judged off to blessing, and others off to condemnation. But the oppressed, and this has been the picture throughout the book, this book, of those who were oppressed, those who were martyred, those who were afflicted, those who had to flee. And the Lord just said, be patient, be patient, be patient. Your vindication is coming. And here the vindication is put forth in bold terms. They're safe in their eternal state. They are safe in God's hands. They are safe in the reign that he has lifted them up to. And you might think, well, that presents a bit of a problem or a question anyway, maybe not a problem. But all right, well, these resurrected saints in glorified bodies, heads reattached, restored whole, will these saints in their glorified bodies be somehow coexisting with those who are still living in the natural state? How does that work during that 1,000 years? And that can get people stirred up to saying, well, to see this has to be spiritual, right? Well, my question is, why? Jesus was in his glorified body, walking around and among the rest of us in a natural state, functioning just fine. Why is that a problem? Particularly for those who are seated on the thrones, as God promised, exalted in their position because of their resurrected, glorified condition. To me, that's no problem at all. In fact, lends credence to the idea that those who rebel in the final rebellion, when Satan is released, have even less excuse, because they've been sitting under the rule of Christ and those who are commissioned by him and serving with him in the rule and reign, experiencing what righteous society looks like, and still say, we don't want it. We want us. So that is what we've just described, is the beginning of the end of sin. That the adversary is going to be bound for a time. And that the victims of the adversary during that time of binding will rule righteously with the Lamb with a rod of iron, and God will be glorified for this extended period of time. We're going to, in a couple of weeks, we'll pick up at verse 7. We'll look at the rest of this chapter and see how death and Hades and sin are once and for all done away with. We've just got the, we've seen the prelude right now. In a couple of weeks, we'll see the finale. And it's a glorious finale. So with that in mind, let us close in prayer. Thank you, Father, for your mercy. Thank you for the privilege that it is to be your servants. Thank you, Father, that there is an end of sin that is coming. And we thank you that you've already put that in motion in our own hearts. Truly, as Christ has redeemed us and acquitted us and his righteousness imputed to our account. But Lord, now we continue to struggle with our fallen flesh. But the day is coming when the struggle will be over. And Lord, whether we are numbered among the martyrs or simply of those who are gathered to your bosom in your good time, Lord, let us rejoice in your sovereign hand in our lives. And rejoice that the adversary can do no more than you allow. Rejoice that the Lamb is victorious and has conquered death and the grave and sin. We pray these things in his blessed name. Amen.